Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes. So
What
you
a
hear
great
me as well.
invention. Okay, let me put this down. So, we're in Parshat Toldot, and there's a leaf blower right outside my window. The mo noisiest machine, but it will be temporary torture. Just for me, not for you. So, Parshat Toldot. Lama ze ani. Lama ze ani. Why is this I? Bobby, can you hear me? Yeah, okay, good. Why this I? So the subtitle is Consciousness Only. And I want to talk about the selfing process. What are the ways we are conditioned to see ourselves and others as separate, solid selves? And what is actually going on underneath this facade of being in this moment, in every moment, underneath this reflexive, perpetual attempt to appear as a passably decent being in this world? Are you a somebody? Are you becoming a somebody? Am I? Have you noticed how much energy the ego mind expends trying to piece you together as a somebody? How many thoughts on and off the cushion are about who you are and what's up with you now? Are you appearing to yourself and to us as a satisfactory somebody? And how the mind invests in battering and cajoling us into being better, smarter, kinder, clearer, clearer self. I remember the first time I heard a meditation teacher, perhaps Shoshana Cooper, say, "You are not a problem to be solved." And so, I mean, reading it now, what comes to me is, what? I shouldn't go. Never mind. So this week's Parsha Toldot challenges the notion that we're problems to be solved. And Toldot means generations, descendants. And in our Parsha, there's a deceptive switch of identity that will reverberate through history. The word Toldot shares its root with yeled or yelda, boy, girl, yom holedet, birthday, the word for midwives. I don't have that here. The root of the word toldot has to do with the most fundamental reality of coming into being, into form, bearing a child, being a child, facilitating birth. The root toldo is also related to the word for history. So, not only the conflicting stories we tell ourselves and each other as individuals, but the conflicting stories we tell of our collective coming into being as peoples, as nations, genders, races, religions, and so on. The toldot stories look at some of the factors that shape the identities of our foremothers and forefathers. This is the parasha when the twins emerge from Rebecca's womb. Esau is the first to materialize, followed by a few pushes later by Jacob, holding on to his brother's heel. Hence the name Yaakov, heel. A heel is a person who treats others badly or unfairly, as in, quote, "I felt like a real heel when I saw how I upset her." When the twins grow up, their mother, Rebecca Isaac's wife, plots to give the birthright blessing not to the oldest son, who is Isaac's favorite, but Esau, the hairy hunter. Instead, give it to her own favorite son, Yaakov. Okay. The Torah and commentaries use this dramatic moment to peer into the depth of what is authentic identity. Dr. Aviva Zornberg writes, "Truth to self is not a simple concept." From The Murmuring Deep, her book, that you basically cannot rely on your senses to judge the self or other, just as you cannot judge a book by its cover, or how we cover it with false book jackets. Rachel covers Jacob, with animal skins to make him like hairy Esau. Then she prepares Isaac's favorite meat to trick Isaac into thinking he's giving Esau the blessing of the birthright. She takes advantage of Isaac's blindness. Commentaries suggest, his blindness is the result of the Akedah. When the angels wept for this baby Isaac, about to be slaughtered by his father, their tears fell into Isaac's eyes, which became weak and eventually blind. Isaac says, "This is the voice of Jacob, but the voice of hairy." Oh, this is not. What is this? "This is the voice of Jacob, but the texture of the hair is Esau." Strangely, Jacob's main fear is not about stealing the birthright, but about how he may appear to his father as a trickster. Water here. At this moment, Esau appears and Isaac realizes what has happened and he's seized with trembling. "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me as my favorite dish? And I ate it all before you, Esau, came, and I blessed him, Jacob." Then there are four more mysterious words that come out of Isaac's mouth. "Indeed, he is a blessing." Zornberg says that Isaac does not insist on his unconsciousness at the time of the blessing, exhorted under false pretenses. Instead, instead, Isaac ratifies what happened. When he says of Jacob, "Indeed, he is a blessing. He is blessed with the essential heritage of the blessing of Abraham." Nevertheless, Isaac will spend 20 years running from his brother. When Jacob returns finally to confront his brother for the first time, he spends the previous night wrestling with an ish. An ish is the word in Hebrew for person or spirit or part of his psyche. When dawn breaks, the ish must leave, and Jacob demands that the ish bless him. And his blessing is the new name, Yisrael, the one who struggles with God. Or let's say the godding process. The struggle that has repeatedly gotten him in trouble is now his new name. Now his identity takes on the aspect of reality that is beyond blessing or curse. Sometimes a hug does not look so different than a wrestle. His new name as struggler indicates his embrace of his nature, rather than forever trying to wrestle it into something else, something different. When I was born, my granddaughter, when my when when my grandmother was born, no, my granddaughter, there we go. When my granddaughter was born, she was not trying to be a somebody. I remember this vividly. She was it's about like 10 years ago now. There could be a poignant, deep cry of suffering ending abruptly by the human generosity for nourishment at the mother's breast. On one hand, life was simple, simply lifing her. She could not resist being with that flow. She was ever present. But on the other hand, she was deeply studying how to be a person, to be a somebody, watching us closely, copying everything we did. I'd say something and she would repeat it. She absorbed our speech, our cadence, our underlying subtleties, and not so subtle emotional valences. She internalized the way we dealt with her and with each other, and how we lived this guiding process in ourselves. As soon as she could barely stand, tottering on her two little feet, when we loaded the dishwasher, she loaded the dishwasher too, beaming with elation for standing upright and engaging what we were doing together. In our lives, from the outside, we see people we think are somebody. We see us as somebody too. But from the inside, it doesn't feel that way. 6 years ago, I went on a book tour for my second book, Connecting with the Enemy, A Century of Palestinian-Israeli Joint Nonviolence. And I listened to how people introduced me at each stop throughout the U.S. and Spain and Northern Ireland. And I thought, that sounds like an interesting person, but she would be intimidating to me. Do you remember when you were around puberty and a new kind of self-consciousness grew as our bodies were changing, our minds were expanding? I remember being on a summer camp bus late at night. It was Camp Eisner, a life-changing event. I was about 12, coming home from a dance with the boys' camp, staring out the window, the black darkness, riding the deep darkness of the night sky that outlined the peaceful, hulking hills of the Berkshires. It was a moment of wordless longing, confusion, a sense of self trying to organize different distinct pieces of life to form a me. But it was all pretty hazy. And while people around me appeared to be somebody, inside me, it was all fluid, unnameable, wondrous, sorrowful. I think I assumed that I would cure myself of this one day, when I totally became somebody recognizable, at least to myself. But 60 years later, I don't think my long resume of achievements of being recognized as multiple somebodies, professor, mom, historian, wife, sister, artist, singer, meditator, these accumulated somebodies can't make a dent on my insides, which still feel fluid and ineffable, still wondering, what's this life, this being, this world? Which I remember Tracy Chapman's song, Fast Car. She's started from zooming, nothing to lose, me, myself, I got nothing to prove, just the border into the city, and finally what it means to be living. Whoa. And your arm felt nice wrapped around my shoulder. And I had a feeling I could be someone. So we do spend enormous energy constructing, reconstructing, deconstructing, imagining, reimagining ourselves and each other as somebodies, but our internal experience never matches with those who we think we are, of how we think we are, or want to be. Language, labels, identities can't capture this being alive, this ever-changing flow of moments of lived experience that can never add up to a somebody. How often do we long to be or have some aspect of someone else that appeals to us? Yes, that's a real person. That's what I want. And the ego is all about itself, especially its lack, its loneliness, its judgments, its comparing mind. It wants to be new and improved. And how can I become a better person? Okay, I would settle for becoming a more bearable person. But can I please have a better mind, heart, body, spirit? Can I learn to be a better meditator, partner, mother, friend? Can I learn how to love better and to fight better for justice, compassion? Comparing mind grips us as shame, as jealousy, longing, pride, mingling in this soup of our desires and aversions. I heard a retreatant once describe her observation of the continual little waves of shame and pride as a constant hum along the surface of the mind. Shame, pride, shame, pride. The Buddhist Pali Sutra talks about eight worldly winds, eight worldly winds: status and disgrace, praise and blame, loss and gain, pleasure and pain. It says they all come and go like the wind. To be happy, we rest like a giant tree in the midst of it all. And when we look deeply into these processes, into the midst of them all, we catch the mind constructing its imagined separation and solidarity. You may know that the Buddha refused to answer the question of whether a self actually exists. Instead, our practice is to look carefully at the processes that give rise to an apparently discrete self over and over and see if they are true. So we sit still, we pay attention to what and how the mind notices and takes in the sensory world around us. We chafe against repetitive old voices, conditioned attitudes that bind us to our small story, to our constructed finitude. Mindfulness allows us to wrestle with the Ish, with whom Jacob wrestles, those parts of ourselves we can't bear or can't forgive for the ways they hurt us and others. Paying close attention, loving moment-to-moment attention, releases us from the bondage of this Mitzrayim, this narrow perception of ourselves, of our lives, where no amount of somebodying can curse us or take the suffering. Several years ago, I ran into the teachings of 4th century Indian sage Vasubandhu, who many Buddhist lineages claim as their founder. Vasubandhu was famous for settling century-old philosophical arguments between early Buddhism and later Mahayana Buddhism that had to do with the nature of reality. His work, Yogacara, means yoga practice, or joining together, or uniting. I accessed the book when a young American Zen Buddhist priest, Ben Conley, reinterpreted Vasubandhu's work in a book entitled Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. Conley unpacks Vasubandhu's 30 verses, which teach consciousness only. Consciousness only posits this: all that we experience and perceive, and every way that the world comes into us, and the basis for all our beliefs, actions, reactions, and plans, as well as the lens through which we collect all the data about what seems real and true, happens through eight consciousnesses. Okay, I don't know. By identifying these eight consciousnesses, our mindfulness practice becomes a kind of intervention to release us from the grip of moment-to-moment, ego-driven lives, hogtied by greed, hatred, and delusion that cause suffering for ourselves and for others. Recognizing these eight consciousnesses, paying close attention to them, opens space to wake up in our lives. So in order to free ourselves and others from suffering, we must loosen the grip of painful, afflictive emotions and learn to manifest beneficial ones. So I'll just name quickly the name of these sense organs. Each consciousness has three aspects: a sense organ, sense consciousness, and a sense object. So there's ear, there's nose, there's tongue, there's body, there's mind. I don't know if that's six. One, two, three, four, five, six. I don't know. this is the totality of our moment-to-moment experience. Placing close, non-judgmental attention, moment-to-moment, we can see that these things come and go in a process of endless change. We begin to disidentify with them as self, not as holding them so tightly as fears come and go. Liking this, not liking that, wanting to be this way, not wanting to be that way. We begin to see that what we thought was real is, as Connolly writes, in large part a creation of the habits of consciousness, a manifestation of unconscious narratives intimately connected to the ways we experience emotions. Oh, I think this is getting too long. Okay, I'm going to end it right there because I want to have time for us to talk to each other. Thank you for listening. I'm going to click out of this and hopefully still be with you. I think I won't. Let's see. I'm afraid always to click anything. I'll never find anything again. Okay. So, your turn to